From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, it was a wild ride in the news. Once celebrated General David Petraeus out as CIA director. Benghazi back. Israel and Hamas trading rockets. Political positioning on the fiscal cliff and a record fine for BP. Generals and scandal crowded the headlines. Sex, threats, and national security. Congressman Peter King of New York summed it up on the Today Show.
This has the elements in some ways of a Hollywood movie or a trashy novel, but at bottom line, you're talking about families, you're talking about outstanding military leaders and the impact it has on the country.
On Wednesday, in his first post-election press conference, President Obama defended Ambassador Susan Rice after Republican attacks on her early read on Benghazi.
For them to go after the UN ambassador, who had nothing to do with Benghazi, and was simply making a presentation based on intelligence that she had received, and to besmirch her reputation is outrageous.
And high tension as rockets fly in and out of Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had tough words for Hamas.
I hope that Hamas and the other terror organizations in Gaza got the message. If not, Israel is prepared to take whatever action is necessary to defend our people.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Margaret Taleb of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What do you see in Gaza, in the fall of Petraeus, the BP fine, the fiscal future? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is David Ignatius, associate editor and columnist for The Washington Post, with a long view of the CIA and more. David Ignatius, welcome. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom.
Also with us from Washington, Margaret Taleb, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News. Margaret, welcome back. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you, Tom. And hi, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Margaret.
Can we go first, if we might, to Israel and Gaza? At this moment, the latest I see here is Israeli troops and a lot of equipment on the borders of Gaza, not in yet, though depending where you are, by the time you hear this, they may be. 450 aerial assaults hitting 450 sites, Israeli aerial assaults by early Friday, and 300 rockets into southern Israel from Gaza, Hamas, since Wednesday. At least 130 more intercepted by Israel's anti-missile defense system. David Ignatius, what do you see unfolding here in Israel and Gaza?
Well, Israel's obviously positioning itself for a possible ground invasion of Gaza. All the indications that we've gotten over the last several years are that the Israelis would be reluctant to go in and have that kind of fight as they did several years ago with what they called Operation Cast Lead. That said, if the rockets keep coming, and they've come in this case closer to the population heartland of Israel
into Tel Aviv, yeah.
Than ever, then I think, in a sense, Prime Minister Netanyahu will have no choice but to take action on the ground. I think that the key player off stage, if you will, that everyone is watching is the new Egyptian president, Mohamed Morsi, and the question of how he will react to this very intense military conflict on his borders. Many people see Hamas as a virtual offshoot of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood from which Morsi and the governing party now are drawn. Will they feel forced to take sides in this conflict in a way that would put Israel's peace treaty with Egypt in jeopardy? And that would significantly raise the stakes in this conflict. And I think that's the thing that the Israelis have to be careful about as they move forward, not to see the basic architecture of their security unravel.
But definitely a new dynamic there already. Here on Wednesday in a press conference, the Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi condemned Israel's attack, beginnings of that attack, on Gaza.
Our position has been clear since yesterday, and we've expressed it by pulling our ambassador from Tel Aviv and sending a letter of protest to the Israeli ambassador here in Cairo. We've been in touch with people around the world. I've asked for an emergency Arab League summit to end this assault. I've also asked the UN Secretary General to ensure that international bodies end this assault.
Margaret Tolliff at the White House, how is the Obama administration interpreting, if you know, this flurry of missiles out of Gaza? We see Israel firing back and maybe going in, but what's the new dynamic or incident that prompted this flurry of rockets out in the first place?
Well, Tom, it appears to have been the airstrike, the taking out of a Hamas military leader a couple of days ago, and this all has escalated very quickly. It is the last thing that the White House wants to have on its plate right now. The president is getting ready to leave for a trip to three Asian countries next week, wants to put the focus back on China. He's trying to deal with the fiscal cliff. He's got this Petraeus stuff blowing up and a year-end deadline. And the specter hanging over all of this, of course, is what happens with Israel and Iran. What happens with Syria, what happens with Egypt, and the theoretical prospect of nudging the U.S. closer to engagement in something that resembles war on some level, which is like, okay, he did not want to be dealing with this at the end of the year.
Jack, we've got something resembling war right now, maybe just straight war in Syria, civil war. And then on Wednesday, of course, that top military commander of Hamas was killed in an Israeli airstrike as he rode in his car. Israel firing into the Golan Heights a couple of times in response to Syrian fire there, and a new dynamic surrounding all of this, Jack.
Yes, especially in that Egyptian complication that David brought out. I have a question for David. A letter to the editor today from the Times from the Consulate General of Israel in New York points out that 800 rockets have been fired at Israeli communities this year alone. 800 rockets.
Out of Gaza.
Out of Gaza. They are not manufactured there. According to David Kirkpatrick's reporting in the New York Times, Morsi has actually been tougher on the tunnels and the smuggling through Egypt than was Mubarak. They must therefore come in via ship. And a couple of years ago, David, I was under the impression that there was some talk of an internationally run blockade that would effectively prevent, or go as far as that can be done, those rockets from getting into Gaza. Where is that conversation, and is that at all an answer here?
And where are they coming from, David?
Yeah.
It's a good question, Jack. A few of these rockets are, in fact, cobbled together in Gaza from raw materials, as I understand it. I think there has been some action on the tunnels by the new Hamas government, Muslim Brotherhood government in Egypt. In terms of a total sea blockade, it's pretty total as it is. The famous flotilla that came to try to deliver relief supplies with Turkish ships that led
not
the
missiles,
Israeli,
but more generic
no, they were,
relief.
They
yeah.
were. Well, there was some question about precisely okay. what was on those vessels, but the very tough Israeli action to prevent those ships from coming to Gaza illustrates the virtual naval blockade that exists. One more thing I would mention that's been in the background here has been an effort by Morsi's government in Egypt to broker a rapprochement between Hamas and Fatah, the more moderate group mm-hmm. that rules the West Bank. And he seemed to be getting closer and closer. And the Israelis have watched this. They don't like it, but they have been willing to let give people some string to play with. And I think their decision to go after the military leader, take the consequences in terms of rocket fire, and then respond as aggressively as they have, suggests that there's I think they haven't done this by accident. I don't think they're stumbling into this. Mm. They're in the window between the U.S. presidential election and the Israeli parliamentary election, which
What's
is
What's the goal
in late
that you're
January.
Suggesting there, David?
Well, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu, who held back all fall after a lot of tough talk from any unilateral action against Iran, is trying to show Israelis that in terms of Israeli security, he is as aggressive as any prime minister and as he thinks Israelis expect a prime minister to be. Whether that's going to play as we head into the January elections, whether missiles falling on Tel Aviv is going to end up hurting him or will galvanize the public behind him, we'll have to see. Some Israelis tell me it could hurt him quite a lot.
Questions from our listeners here. Dory in Mansfield, Connecticut. Dory, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to ask about specific U.S. responsibilities and role here, having to do with a lot of the technical support people discussed back during Iron Lead, Cast Lead, whatever the Israelis.
When Israel went in hard to Gaza last time. Yeah, okay, question?
Yeah, and there was air involvement. There's, you know, constant air involvement. Is the U.S. already providing technical support for that? And in some ways, does the world, the region, see America as already a partner with Israel in these kinds of operations?
Well, I don't know about these kinds of operations too precisely, but Margaret Talev, certainly over many decades, a partner. Does the new chemistry with Egypt and the rest of the region change the U.S. position when it comes to even technical support of Israel in a moment like this, Margaret?
The public posture yesterday, both on background and on the record from the White House, is that the U.S. recognizes Israel's right to self-defense and that it is up to Hamas to de-escalate. What these readouts and briefings and public comments have not talked about is what the White House is saying to Israel behind the scenes. Obviously, they're saying you have the right to defend yourself, but what else are they saying? Are they urging de-escalation on their part also and just not making it public? These are details that are not being disclosed, right? But right now, the public posture by the White House is to recognize Israel's right to self-defense and to ask our allies who talk to Hamas to get them to de-escalate.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Petraeus topples, Israel and Hamas square off, a fiscal cliff. Well, in front of us, and a lot of posturing about that, Obama meets the press for the first time since the election this week. David Ignatius is with us from the Washington Post. Margaret Talev, White House correspondent for Bloomberg News, is here. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Kevin in Amherst, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm just wondering, if the shoe was on the other foot in Gaza, if Hamas had killed the Israeli defense minister, would we be then defending Hamas for, defending themselves after an Israeli strike on them? Why do we always lean toward Israel when they were the primary aggressors in this?
And you're saying that with the killing of the Hamas military leader?
Yes.
Of course. I mean, yes, point taken. That was a clear strike, and they took out a top guy, and the Egyptian leadership as well was very unhappy about that. But then they tie a lot of earlier history back to that leader. We will pick it up, Kevin. Let me get one more call first. Susan, East Hampton, New York. Susan, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to ask, it seems to me that everybody, the media, is very upset at Israel's reaction to Gaza and in the 800 rockets that they've lobbed into Israel. I would like some comment as to why it seems to me that the outrage is never equal. You don't hear much about happening when Hamas has been lobbing these rockets in.
I don't know if it's outrage, Susan, but that's how you hear it. David Ignatius, I mean, this gets back to the conflict goes back and back and back. Our first caller says, they killed Hamas top defense guy from the sky. You don't expect a reaction. Susan says, what about the missiles that came earlier out of Gaza? Where's the original sin here, David?
Oh, goodness. The original sin is so deep in the history of this part of the world. Just a couple of comments. First, Israel is a close ally of the United States. Both candidates in the presidential election said that, and it's a reality of the situation. So if we lean one side as opposed to the other, it's because we regard Israel as a close ally, and we regard Hamas. I believe there's been legislation passed to this effect. We regard them as a terrorist organization. Second point, I think it becomes increasingly difficult for the United States to criticize not just Israel, but anyone who uses the technique of targeted killing at a time when we are using drones to attack our adversaries, not simply over the tribal areas of Pakistan, where the most dangerous Al-Qaeda core killers were located, but in other battle spaces now, in Yemen, in Somalia, it's just very, it would be hypocritical for us to tell another country, I think, you can't use the same weapons that we're using on such a regular basis. So I think that mutes any comment the U.S. might otherwise make.
Talk about a great big standing fact. And of course, yes, that alliance, well trumpeted. We're going to look more at this new and evolving situation, Israel, Gaza and Hamas and the surrounding countries and their changes on Monday. Let me move, if I may, to the big noise this week over Benghazi. On Wednesday, Senator John McCain told Fox News that despite the Obama administration's opposition, an investigation on the handling of the attack on the consulate in Libya must happen, he said. He said it should be like the Iran-Contra or Watergate investigations.
Obviously, they're not going to want it. They didn't want a 9/11 commission. The Bush people didn't, that Joe Lieberman and I proposed. They didn't want the Watergate committee. They didn't want the Iran-Contra committee. It's going to require the American public demanding it.
And more than that, could Susan Rice be the next Secretary of State? McCain saying no. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, no. On CBS with Bob Schieffer, he said he would not vote. He would be totally against that on the basis of her readout on the Benghazi attacks. Here's Lindsey Graham.
There are too many questions to be answered. I don't quite frankly trust her rendition of Benghazi, so I think Susan Rice would have an incredibly difficult time getting through the Senate. I would not vote for her unless there's a tremendous opening up of information explaining herself in a way she has not yet done.
Margaret Taleb, and then we heard the president come out. We heard it right at the top of the hour with that very hot defense of Susan Rice against John McCain and Lindsey Graham and their attacks. Of course, nobody likes to see one of their ambassadors rhetorically attacked. But why the president so hot under the collar about this one, Margaret?
Yeah, there was a lot of reaction after the fact. Like, of course he had to defend her, but wow, did he consider the political implications of that sort of level of defense? I think there's a couple things going on. Number one, he just won re-election, and Secretary of State is sort of a diplomacy job, and he doesn't like it that these two Republican senators, one of whom ran against him, first time around, are throwing down a marker and trying to preemptively block someone whom he's very close to. And number two, he is very close with her. He's very loyal to her. She's very loyal to him. And the president and his advisors really feel like that she's being unfairly attacked for having gone out on those Sunday shows and saying what they told her was the information to say at the time. And so it is unclear to me whether at this point the president is determined to go to the mat for her no matter what, or whether in the back of his head he figures, well, if this isn't going to happen, the least I can do is defend her very strongly. I mean, that's still up in the air, but all official indications are that she's still very much a top contender in his mind for that post. And
Secretary of State, even now.
Yes, yes.
Here he was on Wednesday in that first press conference, really hot under the collar. The president steamed about the attacks on Susan Rice.
She gave her best understanding of the intelligence that had been provided to her. If Senator McCain and Senator Graham and others want to go after somebody, they should go after me. And I'm happy to have that discussion with them.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the words themselves and the palpable emotion here?
Well, obviously, he's deeply committed to Ambassador Rice, and she goes back to the 2008 campaign. As we remember, she was his main foreign policy advisor then. David can comment on this. He's really been the master source. He's pointed out that he's actually quoted the talking points that the CIA distributed that she accurately represented on television. My question to that is this, though. Any public official who takes what the CIA has told them for gospel and without exercising independent judgment regurgitates what they told them, well, that has been a formula for being made a fool. Witness Colin Powell faithfully repeating those falsehoods about WMD and all the rest. And, when you look at the CIA, wrong about the Palestinian election, wrong about Indian nuclear tests, leave out the Bay of Pigs. Wrong, wrong, wrong. And Senator Moynihan, just a decade or more ago, said, look, the Cold War is over. It's time that this intelligence agency was abolished. We don't need it anymore. And as he accurately pointed out, it hasn't really delivered much good intelligence. Most of its effort, at least so far as an outsider can discern, has gone into covering up its own failures, its own
Jack,
policies
post,
and people.
Post 9/11, you'd have no intelligence service for this country?
Well, you'd have some intelligence service, but I'm just saying that one and that the culture of that one has just keeps you know producing bad intelligence. And talking of 9/11, I mean the way they stovepipe information.
Yeah, let us pick it up with David. David Ignatius, you have been right in the middle of reporting on Benghazi. We're getting the first reports out of David Petraeus's testimony, closed door, on Capitol Hill this morning, where apparently he's saying, look, we were telling you, U.S. government, from the start that it was a terrorist attack on the consulate, and Congress people pushing back and saying, well, that's not the way we heard it. That's certainly not what Susan Rice was told, if she was faithfully conveying it there. What do you make of the CIA's role here, what the ambassador knew, when she knew it, what should she have known, David?
Well, there's a legitimate question about whether Susan Rice is the best person to be the next Secretary of State, and Senator McCain and others have every right to challenge that. On this question of the information that she provided when she went on television on September 16, mm-hmm. the Sunday after the attack on the consulate, it is a fact that she was essentially reading from the talking points that had been prepared by the CIA at the request, I would note, of the Republican leader of the House Intelligence Committee. And those talking points made several points, that among the groups that attacked the consulate, there were terrorist organizations, mm-hmm. that the attack itself appeared to have been spontaneous. And the reason
to
that they said that—
To have begun spontaneously or to begun, be in its entirety?
Well, you know, they don't know, mm-hmm, and they don't know to this day. But just to note a mm-hmm. point for Jack, certainly the CIA makes a lot of mistakes, but I think one should be a little careful in that kind of blanket criticism. In terms of this specific report, the reason that they said it appeared to be spontaneous was that they had intelligence surveillance of some of the attackers watching the demonstrations in Cairo over the notorious anti-Muslim video live. They were watching the demonstrations on Al Jazeera or whatever. And then they had surveillance of them talking among themselves about the demonstrations in Cairo. And then they had them moving to the area around the consulate. They didn't have insight into the specifics of what they were going to do, their planning, their intentions, and certainly the kind of heavy weapons they brought to that fight suggests they were well organized at a minimum. But that's part of why, from the beginning, they've said it's hard for them to untangle planning and spontaneity in this. It's because of the intelligence that they had.
Here's a couple of different angles, and then I'll come to you, Margaret, but this is a minority leader in the House, the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, Dutch Ruppersberg. Or Democrat, saying after seeing how the information was delivered in the closed hearings, he felt he had a better idea of how the Obama administration came to its conclusions about Benghazi.
Once the members were able to see the timeline and things that occurred, I think in the end, the assessment's still the same, that as it relates to Benghazi, you had a group of extremists who took advantage of a situation, and unfortunately, we lost 4 American lives.
Kind of going with the took advantage, spontaneity idea there. But yesterday, Senator Saxby Chambliss, vice chair, Senate Intelligence Committee, told Bill O'Reilly the attack on the U.S. consulate was clearly a terrorist attack.
Here's what we know, Bill. You don't have a spontaneous attack from folks carrying AK-47s and other automatic weapons. You don't have folks with RPGs and firing mortars on a spontaneous attack. This was clearly a terrorist attack.
Margaret Tullev, I've gone back and looked at Susan Rice's statement, and it's a lot more subtle and nuanced than John McCain's sort of broad lambasting suggests. On the other hand, you can definitely hear, you know, read it and say, well, that doesn't line up by any means perfectly with what emerged afterward. Why do you think John McCain's still going so hard on this at this point? And, you know, are we getting a clearer idea of what actually happened at the consulate this week, Margaret?
You know, former CIA director General Petraeus's comments behind closed doors may in fact become important to developing the storyline. And
he went out to Libya after the attacks. He's just back like a week ago or something.
That's
before
right.
all the stuff hit the fan.
That's right. And so, you know, because these are closed door hearings before the House and Senate intelligence panels, we're relying right now on sort of dribs and drabs from Republicans and Democrats who are willing to go to the microphone or talk to reporters. It's not entirely clear to me, you know, whether what he is telling them is easing sort of easing suspicions or just complicating them. Republican Peter King said shortly after Petraeus's closed-door testimony was that Petraeus told them that he knew within 3 days of the attack that it was a terrorist act. And 3 days within the attack gets you to just before the day that she testified that she went on television. So at this point, it seems that it hasn't entirely eased questions, but it may go a long way to beginning to answer them. But, you know, this is like really complicated stuff. And one thing is a policy question and one thing is a political question, which is what does the Republican Senate really want to do in terms of influencing President Obama's next choice for Secretary of State? I mean, Hillary Clinton's not going to stay. It's unclear whether Senator Kerry is someone who they want to take out of the Senate at this point. And so, you know, if those two options aren't there and they don't get Susan Rice, who do they think they're going to get? Who do they want to get?
Yeah. I'll come to you on that. David, Dick's calling from Dover, Massachusetts. Dick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm just wondering, we just concluded an election where foreign policy took a back seat. Why? What's the real motivation of Senators McCain and Lindsey Graham in bringing this to the forefront? I mean, it seems to me it's unfortunate. You know, it happened. People were killed. However, the economy is what America is interested in, not this sideshow about who knew what when, about when folks started taking pot shots at our embassy.
Dick, we've got it. Let me take it to David Ignatius, if I may. David, is this because Republicans feel if more had been known at the time, it might have swayed the presidential election itself? And you've reported plenty on this, David. Do you think there's something worthy here in the Benghazi story of a Watergate, Iran-Contra size, style, scale investigation?
Well, I think the reason that it's come back is that Republicans felt that the issue was diffused because of the way in which the second debate played out and the comment that you'll remember Mitt Romney made, where he said something that the president was able to challenge, referring to a comment the president had made in the Rose Garden the mm-hmm. day after. And then suddenly that issue was deflated for the Republicans, and I think they felt they had a good and important issue. I think the idea of a kind of big joint committee circus-type investigation, let's be honest, that's what these things become.
Yep.
In a sense, it's going to make it harder to do what's important. But Benghazi is important for several reasons. First, to me, it shows how far the CIA has moved in terms of its personnel overseas towards paramilitary covert action and the security people who are necessary to protect officers who aren't adequately hidden. And you have this big, almost public base at the annex in Benghazi.
More paramilitary than intelligence gathering, well, so maybe they didn't know you've written.
They've moved in the direction of being a paramilitary service, not an intelligence service. So that's a big issue to look at. They also clearly didn't make good plans. They didn't have heavy weapons close enough at hand. The military hadn't positioned weapons near enough. And those things need to be changed. And as one CIA official put it to me in a conversation recently, this is the new normal. Places like Benghazi where Americans are at risk, and they've got to have better plans to deal with them. And if that comes out of these hearings, a resolve and a set of plans of how to deal with it, great.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, yesterday, a $4.5 billion fine announced for BP for the 2010 Deepwater Horizon explosion and oil spill in the Gulf. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder.
This marks both the largest single criminal fine, more than $1.25 billion,
and the largest total criminal resolution, $4 billion, in the history of the United States.
Joyce Lovelace, widow of a Kentucky judge who died of fungal meningitis after receiving tainted steroid injections, testified Wednesday before a House committee.
It was a nightmare to see this man who was perfectly healthy one moment and then just so quickly going downhill. And everything the doctors were doing for him was to no avail.
And China's new leadership announced this week at the helm, Communist Party chief Xi Jinping, whose wife Peng Liyuan, in an interesting twist, is a big, big Chinese singer. Here she is with My Motherland. Looking at a big week in the news, Petraeus topples, fiscal cliff posturing, Romney speaks. You can join us. Margaret Tolles here from the Washington White House correspondent for Bloomberg, David Ignatius from the Washington Post, and Jack Petraeus and John Allen. Margaret Tolles, what do you see at this point? Here's the general finally behind closed doors testifying on Libya, but oh my, how much has happened since he went out to look into Benghazi? Is he all done? Is he gone after the hearing today? Is that the last we'll hear of David Petraeus in Washington, Margaret?
No, I don't believe that it is, but my guess is he may want a lower profile for a while. Is that the understatement of the week? But listen, you heard, even though President Obama was obviously totally dismayed by everything that's happened, you heard him still give a very robust defense of the general's military record and his work on the CIA. And you've heard, again, from colleagues of Petraeus's around the country, strong defenses of his work record, even as they said, you know, we're not condoning what happened in his personal life. So I think he does have some reserve of respect, but it's been just a stunning free fall of a week.
David Ignatius, you know this intelligence realm well. Help us out here just with your big sense. Is there something more than meets the eye here? What meets the eye has been messy enough this week. But people are left thinking, well, if there's all this noise, is there some intelligence lapse here? Was there some security lapse here, either with the general, former general, retired General Petraeus, or with General John Allen? What's the bottom line on this thing? Is this just human, foibles, weakness, failings, David, or something bigger or not?
Tom, we don't know. There's still a lot of details that have to come out, but at this point, this looks like a story that is as old as time, as of a powerful, greatly successful leader who has some flaw that's not immediately obvious, who falls into a relationship that's inappropriate and is brought down by it. The Greeks wrote about this sort of thing 3,000 years ago, and as happens in Washington, these scandals widen and they encompass new information that then has to be sifted, and you find something, then you got to start another inquiry about that. And so it's very difficult to say where this will lead. In terms of the CIA, I do think this provides an opportunity for the White House, in choosing a new CIA director, to think about where the agency is and how it can be stronger. And
paramilitary versus intelligence, to that spectrum you were
describing? Well, just in general, in terms of the quality of the work they do, they're so important to us. And when somebody as well-informed as Jack Beatty can say, you know, these people have been missing the ball over and over again, there's a lot of that feeling out there in the country. So whether, you could disagree about details of it, but somehow this is a good time, I think, for the president to speak to a concern about having the best intelligence service we can.
Jim in Cookeville, Tennessee. Jim, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom, thanks. I just wonder if they realize the election is over with all this making hay on the Benghazi thing. But I wanted to point out that had Ms. Kelly not informed her FBI friend, that we would not know about the general's affair, and he would still be the CIA head, and it would be the status quo. And this is an old tradition in the military, the dual life of what they call going native, or as I've heard them call it, trying out the local talent. This is normal in the military.
But Jim, he wasn't out in Kabul anymore. He wasn't at Bagram anymore. He was in Washington.
Yeah, well, he had the good fortune, then he went native. That's what they do in the military. It's very common. It's accepted. It's almost encouraged in some cases.
So what does that say to you? Let's grow up and deal with this. This is the way of all flesh, or this is not okay because he was head of the CIA? What, Jim?
It's the military culture. You've got the big scandal with the Secret Service. You've got the Air Force and sexual harassment. I mean, people should see the pattern here. This is normal in the military for military men to not be faithful to their wives when they're gone.
Well, I don't want to lay that on every military man just too broadly here, but point taken that these are long deployments, and there's history here. Jim, in Tennessee, let me take it to Jack. Jack, we've talked about this week. I don't want to beat it to death here. We've got other things to look at, but what are you left thinking on the David Petraeus front?
Well, I don't mean to seem so banal about it, but I really, to me, the remark that stood out this week was made on our show by the military writer Tom Ricks, who said, "I don't write an email that I wouldn't want to see on the front page of the New York Times." Now, he's just a reporter. And these are public officials writing these indiscreet emails. As they say, boggles the mind to think that people can be that naive in this transparent age.
Let's go to the big conference call that got a lot of attention on Wednesday. This was Mitt Romney, recently candidate for president of the United States, lost, talking with some major donors and others about President Obama's victory and attributing it to so-called gifts that he, the president, gave or promised to voters. Here's Mitt Romney in that call.
What the president's campaign did was focus on certain members of his base coalition, give them extraordinary financial gifts from the government, and then work very aggressively to turn them out to vote.
And he singled out the young and Hispanics, Latinos, and African Americans. Lots of pushback on this, not least from Republicans. Here was Louisiana's Republican Governor Bobby Jindal on CNN criticizing Mitt Romney for saying that President Obama won on the grounds of giving gifts to minorities and young people.
This is completely not helpful. This is not where the Republican Party needs to go. We need to stop being the dumb party. We need to offer smart, conservative, intelligent ideas and policies. That's how we win elections. We don't win elections by insulting voters. Again, if you want voters to like you, you've got to like them first. Telling them their votes were bought is not helpful. It's not true. This is not where the Republican Party needs to go next.
Margaret Tolliff, what are you hearing in Washington about Mitt Romney's sort of after-game analysis here? There was a lot of talk. I shared in it about his gracious concession on the election night. But this isn't exactly in the category of gracious. But what do you make of it, Margaret?
No, it was a really ham-handed, conference call to have. I mean, to some extent, it reflects what I heard from a lot of corporate executives who are Romney backers in this past several months of the campaign, which was they were dissatisfied with President Obama's jobs plans or whatever economic job creation stuff. They felt like it was mostly giveaways that wouldn't do much. There was a big sentiment about that, but it's one thing to say it when you're not the candidate. It's another thing to say it when you are the guy who lost and you're trying to pass on a stronger legacy for your party on the next go around. And the primary constituency who people like Bobby Jindal and Chris Christie are worried about, and Marco Rubio, are Hispanic voters. You did hear Bobby Jindal say it's not true, but what you mostly heard Bobby Jindal say is it's not helpful. There's a real feeling in light of these remarks that it's not putting your best foot forward to sound like you have sour grapes and to marginalize people. That may not be what Romney intended to do at all. But
he's calling out groups that he didn't win, and Bobby Jindal saying, please
stop. Don't do that. Yeah,
Lynn in New Haven, Connecticut, you're on the air, Lynn.
Yes, hi. I don't know why people are getting so upset about what Mitt Romney has said. He said the same thing before with the 47%, just in a different way.
Yeah.
I'm an African American. I really like to know where my gift is because I have.
Are you waiting for your gift box?
And then the other thing is, both parties have their constituencies that get entitlements, Medicare, veteran benefits, corporate loopholes, are in the Republican wing of the party, while you have lower class people who might get loans for school.
No, it's a very fair point. Lots of hands, many different ways in there. No question about that, Lynn. Let us just sit with that for a second. Good point made, and I don't know where your gift bag is. Jill in Lakeview, New York. Thank you, Lynn. Jill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
I agree with the previous caller entirely, but I also would like to say that I don't think that Mitt Romney is accepting the fact that he just failed to convince enough Americans that he has the right course, especially women. He alienated women with his obvious tones that he was not intending to protect our rights and our way of living. And in terms of immigration, we understand it needs reforming, but he didn't understand the complexities of it, I think. He seemed to simplify it. Every angle of it has to be looked at, not just strengthening the borders, but temporary work permits and different routes to citizenship for people that want to get to be citizens while protecting our immigration laws.
And a lot of talk about doing just those things among many in Washington now, including Republicans. David Ignatius, the president talked at some length and rather warmly about the possibility, this was in his Wednesday press conference, of Mitt Romney coming in back to Washington or down to play some role in his administration, maybe about cleaning up, managing the government and so on. Is that gone with this comment, David? He did say, the president, that he would sit down with Mitt Romney in December.
I wouldn't think it would be gone. The Romney, this comment is so interesting because it makes you wonder whether Romney really is fundamentally out of touch and out of sympathy with ordinary Americans. The 47% comment during the campaign, I wondered sometimes, was that taken out of context? Hearing this, you think, no, it wasn't out of context. He thinks the people didn't vote for him wasn't.
But it was the same issues, audience. It was big donors in the 47% and big donors here. Maybe that is just a shared view.
I mean, I think that Obama understands that he has a challenge here that he, with the fiscal issues, that he can't escape, that he needs help, he needs bipartisan help. And if he thought that Mitt Romney could help him get a big, significant breakthrough piece of legislation passed, I think he would reach out to him, and I think he'd be smart to do that.
Let's look at the
even
big,
with these stupid comments.
Yeah, well, maybe he still will. Let's look at the big, significant one, the cliff right in front of us. Here was Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader. It's been sort of John Boehner, good cop, Mitch McConnell, bad cop when it comes to standing toward the president here on the fiscal issues and the fiscal cliff. Here's McConnell on Tuesday.
The time for the president to lead is now. And that means offering a concrete plan that takes into account the fact that half the Congress opposes tax hikes. Not because we're selfish, not because we're stubborn, but we know it is the wrong thing to do.
Mitch McConnell, no tax hikes. On Wednesday at his press conference, the president defended raising taxes on upper-income Americans to avert the fiscal cliff.
If there was one thing that everybody understood was a big difference between myself and Mr. Romney, it was when it comes to how we reduce our deficit, I argued for a balanced, responsible approach, and part of that included making sure that the wealthiest Americans pay a little bit more. I think every voter out there understood that that was an important debate, and the majority of voters agreed with me.
Hard to argue that it was very clearly articulated in the presidential contest. Jack Beatty, what do you make of the where the fiscal cliff debate is going as the clock ticks toward the end of the year?
Well, I think the president made a significant statement when he said, what I will not do is have a process that says we're going to sort of kind of raise revenue through dynamic scoring or closing loopholes that have not been identified. And, of course, John Boehner last week essentially said that. He said, we're going to close loopholes. He didn't identify them. And then this elixir of the Laffer curve, you cut taxes and you raise revenue, that'll take care of between the loophole closing and the Laffer curve, everything will be fine. I'm delighted to see the president saying none of this talk about the sophistry about dynamic scoring. We want real numbers. We want real cuts. And above all, we want real revenue.
Margaret, what do you see? The president meeting today with congressional Republicans. This is not something he does all the time. Do you think he'll get back in the cockpit with John Boehner trying to hash it out, trying to keep it at arm's length? Are we going to have a crack up here or just blow through over the cliff or a solution?
My guess is that we will not see him at the sort of arm's length that he was perceived to be last time around. There's a general call from both sides of the aisle on the Hill for the president to engage more. And I'm really talking about Democrats on the Hill saying the president needs to engage more. The president has shown through his news conference earlier this week and his meetings behind closed doors with labor, community activists and such, that he wants to bring them along for input, that he doesn't want to be detached and keep them out of the loop. The question is he really prepared to let tax hikes go up, you know, for everybody else, you know, for a couple days or a couple weeks or whatever to make a point? Or is this just purely a negotiating posture? The initial meeting is just to set the stage. He's leaving for Asia. Everyone else is going home for Thanksgiving. December is when the action really gets started. But the president is attempting, without pounding his chest and screaming, mandate, mandate, to nudge Republicans because of the electoral results, because of investors' frustration, because of corporate CEOs, guys like the head of Walmart, to nudge Republicans into revenue increases in some form, substantially.
New leader tapped in China, and we barely mentioned it, but we will come to it in the days ahead. Jack, on the BP fine, $4.5 billion. It sounds like a lot, and yet it's less than their net profit in the third quarter. What do you think of the scale of that? Right off? Too little? Too much?
Well, you know, it sounds like relatively too little. I am comforted, though, to hear that they may have to pay out as much as $21 billion under the Clean Water Act, which charges as much as $4,300 per barrel spilled.
A lot of little shrimps in the sea still paying the price for that giant deep water spill. We'll see where it eventually lands with BP. Margaret Tala with Bloomberg, thank you very much for being with us, Margaret.
It is always a pleasure. Thank you.
David Ignatius, Washington Post, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
And to you, Jack. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.